academic has now been detained in France for 200 days amid growing calls for her release. As diplomatic efforts continue for her release, activists and Isfandiari's family highlight the broader issues of free speech and political motivations behind her continued imprisonment.
Today marks the 200th day since the illegal detention of Iranian academic Mahdi Isfandiari in France. Isfandiari, who is 39 years old, has been detained since February 28. According to Isfandiari's friends and family, her house was thoroughly searched by security personnel, turning the incident into something eerily resembling a kidnapping. For 2 days following her arrest, no information about her whereabouts was disclosed. Furthermore, French authorities refused for an entire month to provide detailed information to the Iranian Foreign Ministry, which intervened at the family's request. The young woman is accused of, quote, advocating terrorism for having participated in a Telegram channel denouncing the ongoing genocide in Gaza. To justify her continued detention, some investigators claimed that she was acting, quote, under Iran's influence, and that this was a case of interference. Accusations her lawyer, Maître Nabil Boudi, denounces as unfounded and purely political. Iranian authorities have repeatedly called for her release, describing her detention as unjust and politically motivated. Earlier this week, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said Tehran is close to reaching a deal with Paris that will release the Iranian female academic. He said a lot of activities have been done in this regard, adding that Isfandiari's release in exchange for French prisoners in Iran is now approaching its final stages. The top Iranian diplomat didn't give a time frame for the exchange, saying Iran's judiciary and security institutions are also involved in the process. Since her imprisonment, two requests for conditional release have been rejected, first by the Paris court in June, then by the Court of Appeal in July. Isfandiari is now in Fresnes prison, located 470 kilometers away near the capital, Paris. This considerable distance has made it extremely difficult for her family and friends to pursue her case or provide her with any form of support. She happens to be a linguist with a degree in French language from Lumiere University and has lived in the French city of Lyon for the past 8 years. She works as a professor, translator, and interpreter at Lumiere University. Activists, neighbors, and supporters of Isfandiari are denouncing what they see as a serious violation of freedom of speech. Her case is gaining increased attention as calls grow for her immediate release.
Well, Israel has intensified its genocidal campaign in Gaza, as Gaza City remains the focal point of the regime's deadly strikes. 7 people, including 3 children, were killed when an Israeli strike hit a tent sheltering the displaced families west of Gaza City. Separately, at least 10 people were killed in Israeli airstrikes targeting 2 homes on Al-Jala Street, also in Gaza City. Meanwhile, Israeli forces detonated 6 bomb-laden robots to demolish more buildings in the city. According to Gaza officials, since August 11th, more than 1,600 residential structures have been destroyed in the city alone. This as humanitarian crisis is worsening across the Israeli blockaded territory, with rising deaths from malnutrition and aid seekers being increasingly targeted by the regime forces. The death toll from the Israeli genocide since October 2023 has surpassed 64,870, with over 164,600 others injured. Well, as part of an international convoy to break the Israeli blockade on Gaza, 2 Greek aid ships and a British-flagged boat set sail for the occupied Palestinian territories. The Greek ships left the island of Syros and the British-flagged vessel left Tunisia. Across the expanse of the Mediterranean, the global Sumud flotilla presses on with its determined mission to break the Israeli siege on Gaza. Hundreds of activists from 44 countries are part of this international solidarity movement. The flotilla's departure was critically delayed this week following targeted attacks on its vessels. The first attack came on Monday when the flotilla's main ship, the Family, was struck and damaged by an Israeli drone attack in the Tunisian port of Sidi Bou Said. A second boat, the Alma, was attacked on Tuesday night. In Spain, the final stage of the Vuelta cycling race was cut short after pro-Palestinian activists blocked the route, protesting the presence of the Israeli team.
Today, Palestine won La Vuelta. The truth is that Spain and Madrid came together like never before. There will be no awards ceremony. It has already been cancelled. We did it. We won today. The people are greater than everyone else. The people are greater than the government, and Palestine will be free.
Protesters carrying anti-Israel banners partly blocked the road and forced riders to stop. Clashes broke out as the Spanish police attempted to disperse the demonstrators. The disruption is part of a wave of protests that have marked the race over the past week, with pro-Palestinian activists demanding the exclusion of Israel Premier Tech from the competition amid the ongoing war in Gaza. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has expressed his support for demonstrators, saying he admires those who mobilize for just causes. Meanwhile, in the Netherlands, thousands of demonstrators marched through the streets of Groningen, holding a long red banner in a symbolic protest against what they describe as their government's complicity in the Gaza crisis.
More action of the Dutch government to boycott, to put sanction on Israel, because if not, this genocide will not stop against the Palestinians. And in the West Bank, they are building more and more settlements, so the two-state solution is further and further away. And they commit murders on journalists also.
We are here today to draw a red line against the genocidal violence that Israel has put on Gaza and the Palestinian people in general, and how our Dutch government is complicit in the genocide that is unfolding right now in Gaza. We are here because we think it's time to take action, and that the government is being too lazy to actually do anything to stop this genocide and the starvation of the Palestinian people in Gaza right now.
I'm here with the Dutch people to support my country and to stop the aggression, the mass extermination, and the genocide that is taking place in Gaza in a way that goes beyond all statements and beyond all events, wars, and everything that has happened to us throughout history. There is no more Gaza, unfortunately. Gaza is undergoing genocide. There is no red light for Israel to stop, neither from America or anyone else. Where is humanity? Where are the countries that can make a decision to stop what is happening?
Well, in the UK city of Birmingham, campaigners, politicians, and members of the public have gathered to tackle the Palestinian issue and Israel's occupation of Palestine. Saeed Purizah reports.
For decades, the so-called two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine question has dominated Western diplomacy, enshrined in the controversial Oslo Accords of the early 1990s. 30 years on, many here say that solution was dead on arrival.
It's impossible now, in any event, even if it was desirable, which I don't think it ever was, to actually create a two-state proposition, because the West Bank, for example, has been completely atomized by the Zionist entity. So I think we need to rip that idea up and to start again. And what we're campaigning for is a one-state solution.
Critics of the two-state solution, now pushed for by Saudi Arabia and France at the United Nations, also pointed to Israel's ongoing genocidal assault on Gaza.
What they are actually doing is consolidating the gains made by the Zionist entity, which includes the absolute annihilation of Gaza, the continued terrorism that is being taken place by Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And what they actually want to do is consolidate the 80-odd years of Zionist settler colonialism.
The debate organized by activist independent movement grew heated, with some arguing for a state, including all Palestinians and those who live in what's now called Israel, if they wish to stay.
Every Palestinian should have the right to return. And Israelis who decide they want to stay will have obligation to assist the Palestinian to settle back to their home, and that means everywhere.
Opponents of that view argue it resembles South Africa after the end of apartheid, when many of the immigrant white population got to stay.
The concept of, you know, what is mine and what is yours is so simple, and actually people are trying to pretend there's shades of grey. No, actually it's very black and white. There's Palestine and there's a fake terrorist construct called Israel that needs to be dismantled.
Dr. Ali also suggests that armed struggle by Palestinians is the only pathway to one state being materialized.
Armed struggle is legal under international law. And rather than, you know, and what we should be doing is arguing for deprescription of perfectly legitimate legal organizations under international law, we should be never condemning resistance.
At the end of the debate, it was obvious which motion received more support.
With the Israeli regime openly rejecting Palestinian statehood as it commits genocide in Gaza, the debate here mirrors a wider global reckoning. The two-state solution has repeatedly failed. The consensus here, a one-state solution with equal rights for all the indigenous inhabitants of historical Palestine. Saipur is up from Birmingham, United Kingdom.
Well, now joining us from Deir al-Balah is our correspondent Ghada Ibrahim with latest updates there from Gaza. Ghada, again, we have six-year-old twins who have indeed today joined the long list of martyred children, in addition to a disabled woman, with the complete destruction and the continuation of starving of the Gazans there in Gaza. Ghada, what updates you have for us today from there on the ground?
Yes, exactly. As you mentioned, the Israeli genocide continues and taking out the lives of the most vulnerable groups of people. In the past 24 hours, in Nasser Hospital alone, seven children died succumbing to starvation and malnutrition, including three of them were actually premature. And the number is increasing as every passing hour, more people are dying because of starvation and because of malnutrition. More people are still forced to go to the notorious aid distribution centers, desperate for food. And they, as they go every day, they are shot dead and shot directly by the Israeli forces that is opening fire towards them directly, to shooting to kill them. And this number of the fatalities or the casualties of the aid seekers is increasing since the beginning of this genocide and since the beginning or the opening of these notorious aid distribution centers. More people are still also falling victim to the Israeli brutal attacks and massacres in Gaza City itself, as Gaza is the focal point of the Israeli aggressive attacks and the central or the focus of the Israeli attacks in the past couple of days. In the past couple of days, at least 50 buildings of the high-rise buildings in the city of Gaza were demolished and leveled to the ground. More buildings are now leveled to the ground, and by that, the Israeli occupation army is turning hundreds and thousands of people homeless and shelterless. And this policy, and by this policy, they are enforcing the people, or forcing them to flee out of Gaza City towards the south of the city. They are terrorizing the people by attacking their homes and attacking the residential buildings and the tents in order to flee from the city of Gaza towards the western, towards the south of the city or the middle area. However, as you know, no place in Gaza is not under attack or spared from the Israeli brutal attacks. This morning, a whole family was killed near Al-Mawasi area. A father, a mother, and two children were killed in Khan Yunis city near Al-Mawasi area. A woman also was killed and shot dead by the Israeli tanks near the west of Khan Yunis city. And she was also with disabilities. She was deaf, and she couldn't hear the sounds of the shooting or the sounds of the Israeli tanks. She was shot dead. And that is actually the scene here in Gaza, or in the south of Gaza itself, where the Israeli occupation army is claiming that it is a safe zone or a safe area, and orders the people in the north of Gaza to head towards or to go to be away from the conflict zone. However, the south of Gaza is witnessing massacres. More people are killed every day in the south of Gaza and El Al-Mawasi area in particular. More people are dying here as well. Yesterday alone, another family of six, of Shabbat family, six of the same family were killed in a tent as soon as they came from the north of Gaza, and whenever once they already set their tent near the west of the Deir al-Balah, they were actually targeted and they were attacked by an Israeli missile that killed them all. So this is not a humanitarian zone. These areas are not humanitarian at all. They are lacking all the basics of life, and they are lacking water, lacking food, and lacking aid, as the Israeli occupation army is still blocking the entry of aid into the Gaza Strip. And what is allowed to enter Gaza is only the commercial goods, and the only a trickle of the commercial goods. And no aid is still, and no aid is allowed to enter Gaza. The warehouses of UNRWA are still totally empty. They are not allowed to receive any aid from the border crossings of Gaza City. So the situation here is really very catastrophic.
Exactly,
Gada,
I am afraid, yes. As you are mentioning there, we can see behind you the ambulances which pulled up of injured people coming out of the ambulances, of perhaps a father carrying a young child who seems to be very limp, perhaps from malnutrition. The devastation and the starvation and the genocide does continue there in Gaza. Ghada Brahim, everyone, our correspondent there from Gaza, from Deir al-Balah, with the updates. Thank you very much for joining us, and please stay safe. The Yemeni army has launched another anti-Israel operation in support of the Palestinian people, striking the regime's targets in the occupied territories with drones.
The UAV force of the Yemeni armed forces conducted a qualitative military operation involving four drones. Three drones targeted Ramon Airport in the Ar-Rashrash area, while the fourth hit a military site in the Negev region of the occupied Palestine. The operation successfully met its intended objectives.
Sariya said the strikes were carried out in response to the crimes of genocide and starvation committed by Israel against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. He added that the operation also came into retaliation for the Israeli aggression against Yemen. Sariya affirmed that Yemen will continue to uphold its religious, moral, and humanitarian responsibilities towards its brothers in Gaza until Israel's aggression against its territory ends and its siege is lifted. Thank you very much. That's all we have for you this hour. Goodbye for now.
The earth and the heavens begin to sing. The angels celebrate the birth of a king. A king who outshines the stars of the night. A beacon of hope. You guide us with your love. Thank you.
the beautiful name you bear. The blessings of God upon you is my prayer. The earth and the heavens begin to sing. This day we celebrate the birth of a king.
On a humid August morning in Washington, a blurry photograph began circulating online. It appeared to show Europe's top leaders, Emmanuel Macron, Ursula von der Leyen, Friedrich Merz, among others, slouched in the White House hallway, heads bowed, waiting for their turn with Donald Trump. AI hoax or a real snapshot of Europe's posture in the 21st century? In truth, it almost doesn't matter, because the image told a larger truth. Europe's role in the so-called Western alliance has shrunk to something more like obedient accompaniment, a junior partner awaiting instructions. And nowhere is that clearer in the case of Iran's nuclear program. Since World War II, the transatlantic partnership has been dressed up as a strategic alliance. In reality, it's been a structure of dependence. America rebuilt Western Europe through the Marshall Plan, but in exchange, it locked the continent into its economic orbit. Washington pressured Europeans to shift from coal to American-supplied oil. It pushed its corporations into Europe's reconstruction, and through NATO, established in 1949, it cemented its military primacy, with Europe's defense forever under U.S. command.
Everybody was celebrating but us. And we're the ones that won the war. We won the war. And they helped. But without us, they don't win the war. We're all speaking German. You know that, right? Without us, they're speaking German. Maybe a little Japanese, too.
For decades, this arrangement worked as long as Europe's prosperity grew. But the price hasn't always been clear when it comes to the big questions, war and peace, sanctions and diplomacy. Allies and adversaries, Europe defers to Washington. We saw it in Iraq in 2003, when Britain went along despite massive domestic opposition, while France and Germany's dissent quickly softened. We saw it again after 2022 in Ukraine, where sanctions on Russia devastated Europe's own energy markets and industry far more than America's. And now, in 2025, we see it once more in the European Troika's decision to activate the so-called snapback mechanism under the Iran nuclear deal. On August 29th, Paris, Berlin, and London announced that they would move to reimpose all United Nations sanctions on Iran, sanctions that had been lifted under the 2015 JCPOA. A deal painstakingly negotiated over Tehran's nuclear program. The timing is not accidental. Just 2 months earlier, in June, the United States and Israel carried out coordinated strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities. costly, dangerous, illegal, and inconclusive. Iran's program, though damaged, survived. And so, in a perfect division of labor, the Europeans stepped in with the legal and diplomatic hammer.
Good morning. Yesterday, in accordance with UN Security Council Resolution 2231, the foreign ministers of France, Germany, and my own country, the United Kingdom, notified the Security Council that we believe Iran to be in significant non-performance of its commitments under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
The message to Tehran was blunt. Negotiate directly with Washington or face the return of the toughest international sanctions. Yes, the Europeans dangle an extension of the deadline. But let's be clear that if Iran agrees to direct talks with the United States, is no concession. It's a demand for surrender, and perhaps more striking than the ultimatum itself, is what it reveals about Europe's self-image, or the lack of one.
The European countries must act honestly and responsibly, considering the history of negotiations, considering what they have themselves agreed, as part of their commitments under Resolution 2231, to review their positions and strive to adopt an independent approach, free from influence from two other destructive actors, the Zionist regime and the United States of America.
Europe never lived up to its JCPOA commitments after Washington walked away in 2018. INSTEX, the mechanism designed to shield trade with Iran from U.S. sanctions, never worked. European companies fled Iran overnight, terrified of American penalties. So the notion that Europe now holds leverage, that it can dictate terms, is more theater than reality. But this theater has a director, and he sits in Washington. Marco Rubio, Trump's Secretary of State, admitted it outright. In an August 28th statement, he confirmed that Europe's snapback move was taken under direct guidance from the White House, citing National Security Memorandum No. 2, signed by Trump in February. In other words, the foreign ministers of France, Germany, and Britain were not making independent policy. They were executing Washington's orders. This is not diplomacy, it is subordination. And the Iran case is hardly unique. Think back. When the NSA was caught wiretapping Angela Merkel's phone in 2013, Europe grumbled, then swallowed the insult. When negotiations over a transatlantic trade pact tilted heavily toward U.S. corporations, Europe signed anyway. And when secondary American sanctions forced European banks and firms out of Iran in the past decade, Brussels could do little more than issue statements of regret. Today, Europe finds itself once again reduced to enforcer of Washington's agenda, even as the costs mount at home. Its energy prices soared because of U.S.-driven sanctions on Russia. Its industries now face investment flight to the United States, where cheaper gas and subsidies lure away factories and jobs. Strategic autonomy, the buzzword in Brussels for years, looks more like strategic illusion. The irony is that while Europe diminishes itself, the rest of the world is moving on. New alignments are taking shape across Eurasia. Russia, China, Iran, and others building networks of trade, energy, and security that bypass the West entirely. In this multipolar order, credibility is currency. And on Iran, Europe has squandered it. For Tehran, the EU is no longer a trustworthy partner. Deals signed with Europeans turn to dust the moment Washington disapproves. The commercial space, once available to Airbus, Siemens, or Total, is now occupied by Chinese and Russian competitors. And diplomatically, Europe is seen not as a mediator, but as an extension of U.S. power, irrelevant as an independent player. Donald Trump, never one to mince words, put it plainly this February from the White House. Let's be honest, the European Union was formed to screw the United States. His vice president, J.D. Vance, speaking in Munich days earlier, was even blunter. America can do nothing for you, and there is nothing you can do for the American people. Harsh rhetoric? Yes. But look at Europe's behavior, and it almost validates the contempt. When leaders bow, literally or figuratively, in the White House corridor, what message does that send about sovereignty, about relevance? Europe's snapback decision against Iran is not about Iran alone. It's a symptom of something larger, a continent that no longer believes in its own capacity to shape the world, that no longer takes risks on its own principles, that no longer acts except through the shadow of American approval. The photograph, real or fake, of European leaders waiting for Trump may have been a hoax, but it captured something true. The waiting room has become Europe's place in global politics. Unless Europe rediscovers autonomy, invests in its own security, and reclaims diplomatic initiative, it risks becoming not a pole in a multipolar world, but a relic remembered only as Washington's loyal lieutenant. And for Iran, for Russia, for China, for the global South, the conclusion is already drawn. Europe is not an independent actor. It is an instrument. That is the reality behind the snapback mechanism. That is the story of Europe in 2025. For all the talk of the Western Alliance, the truth is simpler and starker. There is no West. There is America, and there are its followers.
IRIB English Radio.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesti. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The New York Declaration, hailed by its architect as a roadmap to peace, has ignited fierce controversy over its treatment of Palestinian rights. While 142 nations endorsed the resolution at the UN General Assembly, critics argue that its emphasis on disarming Hamas and excluding it from governance, coupled with vague commitments to Palestinian sovereignty, mask a deeper failure to confront the realities of occupation, displacement, and systemic inequality. By prioritizing geopolitical optics and appeasing Western narratives, the declaration risks entrenching the very injustices it claims to resolve. I am Bahman Urayi, and in tonight's Spotlight, we ask, does this document represent a genuine step towards justice or a diplomatic sleight of hands that sidelines the Palestinian struggle? Let us begin with a short report.
Amid rising tensions across West Asia and the genocide in Gaza, the UN General Assembly has adopted a text endorsing a landmark declaration concerning the realization of an independent state of Palestine. The measure is known as the New York Declaration. 142 members voted in favor of it, 10 against, and 12 countries abstained from the vote, including Iran, Iraq, and Tunisia. The declaration, which was already endorsed by the Arab League, seeks to fully exclude Hamas from leadership in Gaza. Iran's UN mission has listed the reasons why it did not vote in favor of the resolution.
The statement fails to adequately address the root causes of the crisis in the West Asia region and does not provide a realistic solution to end the prolonged conflict. The statement ignores the reality of the Zionists' presence in Palestinian territories and their ongoing occupation. The statement irresponsibly shares the responsibility for continuing this long tragedy, equally between the apartheid occupying regime and the people under occupation. The statement's attempt to condemn the Palestinian right to legitimate defense on October 7, 2023, and justify the disproportionate and horrific crimes of the Israeli regime against Palestinians in response to this right is utterly unacceptable and strongly rejected.
Iran's UN mission stressed that lasting peace in the region can only be achieved through the establishment of an independent, sovereign Palestinian state. The UNGA resolution also called for the disarmament of Palestinian resistance groups. Hamas and other groups say this contradicts international law, which recognizes the rights of the people under occupation. The UN General Assembly's vote came less than 24 hours after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said there would never be a Palestinian state. The New York Declaration vote precedes the upcoming UN summit co-chaired by Riyadh and Paris on September 22 in New York. French President Emmanuel Macron and several other leaders have promised to formally recognize the Palestinian state during the summit. Around three-quarters of the 193 UN member states recognize the Palestinian state proclaimed in 1988 by the exiled Palestinian leadership.
Welcome back. Allow me to get into the conversation with Saeb Shahz, author and West Asia expert, who is with me right now from Belfast. Very good to have you, Mr. Shahz. It's a pleasure to have you on the program. I want to talk to you about, let's go to the heart of the matter. Do you think this declaration's failure to explicitly condemn Israeli occupation and blockade, do you think this kind of violates international legal norms under the Fourth Geneva Convention?
It does, since the responsibility of occupying power, according to the Geneva Convention and its annexes, is to protect the occupied land and not to change any of its landmarks, not to change its demography, not to mistreat the civilians. And then we have the International Court of Justice in The Hague had an opinion which is came out last year calling the Zionist entities presence in the occupied West Bank or Gaza Strip or Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, is illegal, and listed all the illegalities and asked the Zionist entity and the international community and the state actors and non-state actors to help in dismantling the occupation in the West Bank. So once we talk about the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, every aspect of that is illegal under international law. And there is in here contradiction with what the United Nations vote for and General Assembly, or demanding the Palestinian people to to do. We must pay attention to the declaration when it orders the Palestinians, and especially Hamas, who is an elected government by the Palestinian people, and that's the one who overseen these elections was the former President Jimmy Carter of the United States of America. So when they asked them, Hamas must end its rule in Gaza and have and hand over its weapons to the Palestinian Authority. And they say this is in line with the objective of the sovereign and independent Palestinian state. And let me just dismantle that little bit here for you. We have, as Palestinian people, experience with something which they are building on it in here. They called at the time, they call it the Fahd Peace Plan, which is known after that, the Fahd Peace Initiative. And that, and right. Then they called it the Fez Initiative, since it was a proposal went for the Arab League summit in 1982 in Morocco, in the city of Fez. And the Saudi crown prince then, Fahd, he is presented that, and they this in that 1981 they disagreed upon there, because they exclude the Palestinian PLO as a representative from the whole thing, and then they call for the solution to have Palestinian independent state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and Jerusalem right. as a capital, while they recognizing for free the Zionist entity is swallowing the risk of historical Palestine. After that, what happened? The Zionist entity went and occupied Lebanon in 1982, and they declared after that they control most of Lebanon. The international community, led at the time by the American President Reagan, sent their own diplomats to broker kind of agreement, the PLO, to leave Lebanon in 1982. And the PLO agreed that, since it is not Palestinian territory, but with a kind of agreement with the Americans to protect the Palestinian refugee camps. Sabra and Shatila, for example, in here, they agreed with the Americans and the French, and the American and the French deployed 2,000 soldiers to protect the Palestinian refugee camps in Sabra and Shatila. And once the PLO, the Palestinian, left Lebanon in there, what happens? 4 days later, these forces left, withdrawn from the refugee camps. Suddenly, Sharon, the defense minister of the Zionist entity, sent in the Lebanese forces and the Lebanese phalange under the supervision of the supposed to be Zionists and the peacekeepers, American and French, slaughtered all the Palestinians in there. And that was the agreement, the signature of the president of the United States of America, Jimmy Carter, and the French president at the time as well. So how the Palestinian will accept and will believe the international community when they ask them to hand over their weapons, while the top leadership of the West...
We are going to, of course, cover those because we have a lot of questions. I would really appreciate it if you kept the answers more briefly. I wanted to talk exactly, we're going to talk about the disarmament as well. Well, you know that several Arab countries and also Iran abstained from the vote. And the reasons, some of them, especially the Iranian envoy, vocally criticized this declaration for failing to address the root causes of the West Asia crisis. Does its focus on short-term stabilization and disarmament offer a realistic path to peace? Or do you think it merely treats the symptoms while ignoring the structural injustices that perpetuate the conflict?
It's a plan to disarming the Palestinian people. And as I said, what I was speaking about in 1982 and the phase thing, it developed to what they call it the Arab Initiative of 2002, which is as well by an Arab summit. And none of these leaders at the time considered even to postpone this conference with the Arab summit to allow Arafat, who was besieged at the time in Ramallah, to attend that conference. And it went on the back of that thing. which is to create a kind of entity, a weak entity in the Palestinian occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, and didn't emphasize in the right of return for the Palestinians. Let's go with what the French thinking, even if we listen to what the French Foreign Minister Jean Noël Parrot called as fundamental step to isolating Hamas internationally and regionally. He called that the declaration of New York at the time when the Arabic 17 countries signed it, and some of the Arab. He said to the France Inter Radio on Friday, September 12th will be remembered as the day Hamas's final international isolation. So we can understand what that means. Hamas to them, they mean the Palestinian resistance, the Palestinian right for self-determination and to have their own territory and their own state free from Zionist kind of hegemony and security control and occupation. In that kind of possible ceasefire, they talking about deploying what? A temporary international stabilization mission into Gaza. It means as well, plus the Zionist entity occupation, we're going to have international kind of forces in there, which is undercover. They're going to protect the Palestinian people and to provide the civilian population with support and security. We'll find ourselves under more Western occupation, since the Zionist entity wasn't able to defeat the Palestinian resistance. They want to cheat it diplomatically in such a kind of hollow resolutions.
Right, Mr. Sarchas. Well, gladly now we have Said Mohsen Abbas, political analyst and activist, also joining us from London. Said Mohsen Abbas, of course, you know what we are talking about, the New York Declaration. Something very weird is about this declaration is that it calls for a two-state solution and urges Israel to halt settlement activity, and yet it fails to explicitly name or confront the ongoing occupation. What does that say about the credibility of such a declaration?
Well, it has no credibility, as with anything that comes from the Zionist Western fraternity. You have to take it with a pinch of salt. The reality is that we know that this drumbeat about two-state solution has been building up. And of course, a lot of the so-called pressure that has been building up on Israel from Western governments, you know, the token efforts that have been made, the threat to accept a Palestinian state, for instance, all these things are being touted around, but you have to think about who's doing this. There is there's a neoliberal Zionist soft power movement, which is hand in glove, I think, with the hard power Netanyahu sort of murderous genocidal fraternity, but is deliberately cattling people into saying, well, you know, now that you've seen what Netanyahu can do and what the hardline Zionists can do, actually come over and we'll give you the liberal Zionist solution. And the liberal Zionist solution has no intention of dismantling Israel. It has no intention of giving Palestinians the real rights that they deserve, the justice that is actual justice. They have no intention of ever allowing an armed resistance to take shape. They oppose the axis of resistance, which actually has sacrificed people on the ground. So you can see that this is just another kind of, it's a kind of another psyop, another psychological operation to try and herd the Palestinians into whatever they want. Now, if, for instance, the Palestinian resistance was disarmed, we have track records of what the Israelis do when they have a disarmed Palestinian movement. Just remember Sabra and Shatila and what they did in the camps in Sabra and Shatila to the Palestinians and murdering the women, children. So they kill them whether there's an armed resistance or not. It's just that if there's no armed resistance, of course, the Israelis can do it much more easily and they can control the Palestinians more easily. And that's what I think that they're aiming for. That's what all this noise is about. So this bogus NY declaration, so-called, is just another part of that.
Right, Said Mohsen, thank you so much for that answer. Well, Mr. Shah, also I wanted to talk to you about another aspect of this declaration, which kind of assigns equal responsibility between for the ongoing conflict to both the occupier and the occupied. How do you think a framework with the power that doesn't consider the power imbalance between the occupier and the occupied be considered credible?
This is in itself flies on the face of international law, that kind of equation. Since by international law, the Palestinian people are entitled for the self-determination. And this was as well said in the with the Hague, Court of the Hague, to enable the Palestinian people to be able to for the right to practice their right of self-determination. That means how you'll be able to fulfill that. You are legally entitled to use all means to resist occupation. And we understand the international law with dealing with the occupiers. You cannot say the occupiers have the right to self-determination while they are occupying my country. And I am, as a liberation front, trying to liberate my country from occupation. They cannot deal with that. And I'll give you an example, which is applicable to Palestine right now. The Nazi occupation of France, when the Charles de Gaulle was leading the French resistance from the communists to the socialists, to the right, to the left, against the Nazi. And the Nazi there, to make their occupation of France cheaper, they formed what they call it the Vichy regime in there. And the people now, are they expecting the international community to support what's equal to the Vichy regime and hand it over or the territories? That's what I mean. The Palestinian Authority in Ramallah today is equal to the Vichy regime in France at the time. People supported the resistance. People supported Charles de Gaulle and the independence, really true independence of France. Why, when it's come to Palestine, different double standards have to be used? We have to support, and the international community going to support PA, which it didn't send one policeman to protect one farmer from the Palestinian farmers in the West Bank who's been attacked or killed, or and their land being destroyed and their cattle being poisoned or stolen by the Zionist settlers. Only it looks after the interests of the Zionists, keep security for the interests of the Zionist entity. So this is the double standards in here. And telling the people, the PA representing the Palestinian people, I say very clearly, with the PA, with that stand and that position and that track record in the West Bank, which is the settlers from nearly 60,000 in 1993 were in the West Bank, till today nearly a million under their watchful eyes of the Palestinian authority. They don't represent the Palestinian people. And to hand the control and of the West Bank and Gaza to them and to destroy the Palestinian resistance, it flies against justice, and it flies in the face of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination.
Right. You rightfully pointed to the Palestinians' right to self-determination. Said Mohsen, I wanted to talk about this proposed transfer of authority to the Palestinian Authority without elections. Don't you think this kind of violates Palestinians' rights to self-determination?
Absolutely. I mean, they've been violating Palestinian rights from day dot. They continue to impose the apartheid state. There's no talk about neutering Israel in any way, shape, or form. There's no talk about de-Zionizing the Middle East or West Asia, whatever you want to call it. There's no talk of really giving Palestinians equal rights. It's all to do with just a backdoor Abraham Accords, isn't it, really? I mean, Abraham Accords is all about surrender. It's about capitulation. I think one of the greatest PFLP leaders, who was assassinated many, many years ago, said negotiations and these kinds of declaration, you know, you're giving us the choice of what? The sword and the neck. Basically, that's what they want. They want the Palestinian neck to be placed on a wooden stump so that the Israeli sword can fall on it as and wish, how they wish. And of course, you've got the people like Abbas, basically traitors, sellouts, puppets. There are many of these kinds of puppets around the Arab world. If they didn't exist, the reality is Israel wouldn't exist for one day. You have these kinds of puppets in Saudi Arabia, you have them in Qatar, you have them in Kuwait, you have them across all of the Gulf, and that is the reason that the people are powerless, because these agencies take money from the Anglo-Zionist Empire, and then they impose torture, subjugation, surveillance, and control on their people, and they therefore shut up the Arabs from being able to say and do what they really want. And that's exactly what's happening with the PA in that region, and that's what they want to see. By pushing these agendas of the PA taking full charge, what they want is a capitulation, a surrender, an absolute subjugation, and they won't stop there. Once they have the likes of the PA, what you can guarantee is that the push for for their new acquisition in the West Bank, I've forgotten what they call it, Samarra and I think something else, Judea, I think they call it. That's already on the books of people like Smotrich, Netanyahu, and the like. They are basically already wanting to annex that territory. They want Jordan, for goodness sake. They want the west of Jordan as well. They're already pushing beyond into Syria. They want to go to the Euphrates. People need to smell the coffee. Doesn't matter what other things you say or do, Greater Israel is on the agenda, and Netanyahu is after that, and the Americans will support him in whatever shape or form they want. So you have to stop them at the root, and the root is to stop them annexing Palestine and basically marginalizing it through their puppets.
Right, and one final question, Mr. Shahid, please answer in like 30 seconds, because we do not have more time. Could the disarmament clause be interpreted as criminalizing Palestinian resistance under occupation, contrary to UN-recognized rights of oppressed people?
That's when the French foreign minister, Perrault, told the French media, the 12th of September will be remembered as the day of Hamas' final international isolation. This is the what they want. And as I said, what Hamas, when they say Hamas, they don't mean Hamas as a group. They mean Hamas as the Palestinian resistance as a whole. Anybody who holds the gun to face occupation to them is Hamas. Or the French want to make it sounds like they are the final international isolation for them, which is they are terrorists. They want to label the Palestinian resistance as a terrorist. The Palestinian resistance are freedom fighters who are trying to liberate and will liberate their country from this satanic occupation, which is supported by all Western countries. France was one of the first countries to arm the Zionist entity with a nuclear reactor technology. They're the one who armed the Zionist right. entity before the Americans with up the state-of-the-art technology from the Mirage fighters up to the cannons, to the guns, to the nuclear reactors.
Right, thank you so much, gentlemen. I wanted this conversation to go on for hours, but unfortunately, for the sake of time, we have to call it a night. It was a pleasure to have you both on this program, Mr. Saeb Shahid, author and West Asia expert, joining us from Belfast, and also Said Mohsen Abbas, joining us on the 11th hour. Thank you so much for being here, political activist and political analyst, joining us from London. And thank you so much for being with us on another Spotlight.